from KQED.
And this is Michael Krasny live with you from KQED Radio in San Francisco. We just heard President Obama's live news conference from the East Room of the White House and the analysis that followed it. You may want to make a contribution here of your response to the president's news conference. And if so, we'd certainly like to hear from you. Daniel Pink, who is scheduled to be with us this hour, will be with us in the second hour of the forum program, author of a new book called To Sell as Human, The Surprising Truth About Moving Others. But in the meantime, our focus will be on the president's news conference and what came out of it. We'll be talking with Mark Sandlow, but we'd certainly like to hear from you as well. Our toll-free number is available. It's 866-733-6786. You can also email in your responses, and we welcome your emails as well. Forum at kqed.org is our email address, or go to our website and let us know what you thought about the president's speech or elements of it by going to our website, kqed.org/forum, and simply click on the segment, or go to our Facebook page. And of course, you can also tweet us. Our Twitter handle is at KQED Forum. I wanted to bring Mark Sandlow, a veteran political analyst, aboard here. He's associate academic director now with the University of California's Washington Center, Washington editor of the California News Service. Welcome, Mark. Good to have you.
Good morning.
Good morning to you. Well, let's talk first about how we're doing on deficit reduction here, because the president made it sound like there's certainly been progress made, and there seemed to be agreement on that in the analysis. Nevertheless, there's lots more to be done, clearly. And the president seemed to be suggesting that that's not going to be done by cuts alone.
You can play with these numbers in a lot of ways. I think one way, in simple language, to sum up what the president's saying about things getting better is it's getting less worse, which is not exactly what you want to hear. When he talks about $2.5 trillion in deficit reduction that's already been done, what he's talking about is, as we project into the future, that the deficit is going to get worse and worse. We've taken a $2.5 trillion bite out of that. What he's not saying is, thanks to my budgets, the deficit, the national debt will be $2.5 trillion less. So it's a bad situation where the president says at least we're bending it into the right direction. I was interested in his tone in this press conference, to the surprise of most people who've watched Obama in his first term, in his last press conference of his first term. He's terrible at these things. Brilliant speaker, very brilliant man, just terrible at sort of the small talk of politics when he's asked a question of articulating a clear position. Well, I thought he was particularly good this time, but he was good in precisely the ways that are likely to get him in some trouble. He couldn't have been clear. I will not negotiate with Republicans on this debt ceiling. I'm not going to do it. They put a gun to the American people's head, and we're not going to stand for it. Now, that's clear. It's easy to understand. He actually gave some analogies that I thought were pretty effective. But what he's done also is infuriate House Republicans and Senate Republicans. And you heard just now that there have already been responses. He made it very plain that these are not rational people on the other side. And unless they come around to the way that he is, and he pointed out, well, at least three or four times that the American people did just reelect him, well, then they're the ones who are the outcasts. And while I'm not saying whether that's true or not, and I know there are all sorts of people on the left who are going to be cheering that, but it doesn't put Mitch McConnell in the Senate or John Boehner, the Republican in the House, in much of a position to say, well, that's a man I can work with.
Well, he also seemed to indict them as being irresponsible if they don't go along, as he digs into his position and said a lot of things that I suppose the Republicans will jump all over about how this is threatening to so many people who are expecting their checks. I mean, he mentioned, you know, veterans and the troops and just a whole range of people who are relying on these kinds of checks to come in and pay the bills for them. And he said, in effect, look, we have to pay our bills.
Well, the president touched on that, you're right, Michael, in a way that I thought was as close to an honest explanation as a politician has done recently. I don't know why they don't take the next step and be completely honest. You know, there's all this fight about should we reduce spending. This is a spending problem, Republicans keep saying. Or should we tax more? Millionaires get away with paying less than their secretaries, Democrats always say. At its base, this is a fight over the size of government. Do you want a small government with low taxes that doesn't do more than protect for, you know, the national security and a few other things? Or do you want a bigger federal government that taxes more and provides a social safety net? It's a perfectly legitimate fight to have. And at one point, the president sort of intimated that, you know, really this is not about trying to have, you know, sensible deficit reduction because of spending problems, as Republicans say. It's more about starving the beast. Republicans would like tax revenue to shrink up as much as possible so government can do as little as possible. That's a legitimate fight to have, but boy, this is, even for people who study this carefully, this is a very complicated debate. So to have a democracy trying to make smart decisions on things like debt ceilings is very difficult.
Mark Sanlow with us from the nation's capital. And by the way, you can be with us as well. In fact, I'll throw the question out to you, our listeners, whether you're listening on radio, internet, or Sirius satellite. Should President Obama negotiate on the debt ceiling? And let me give you the number. It's toll-free. You can let your own voice be heard and join the conversation here at 866-733-6786. Again, toll-free for you to call us, 866-733-6786. Wanted to touch, Mark, on some other things that came about during this news conference. You know, the last news conference, the president was criticized quite a bit because he seemed to have pretty much his own people there, and it was kind of described and characterized as a bit of a faux news conference. Here, there were press people. What about the selections of those who were asking questions and just about the way things had been orchestrated?
Well, it's very typical. The news conference drives me crazy. You know, for many years I wrote for the San Francisco Chronicle, and what a surprise, George W. Bush never wanted to call on the San Francisco Chronicle to ask him questions. The White House very carefully, what they do is they call on the big mainstream media. They called on the networks. They called on, you know, Bloomberg Television, on ABC News, and they do this for a very easy reason. If you get very confrontational in the White House press conference, there's nothing you can do. It's a free country. It's live television. On the other hand, they can cut off your access. If you have a rogue reporter in there who just doesn't care because they don't have much access to begin with and just start pointing to anybody to ask questions, there are no consequences. So the chance that Chuck Todd for NBC, who I don't think really asked, you know, softball questions, but can't push the president too hard. The reason is because next time NBC tries to get the president on Meet the Press or Face the Nation or whatever shows they have, it's much more difficult to do that. So the questions the president could fully anticipate, you know, again, the people make fun of the White House press corps for being a bunch of sheep. I'm not sure it can work in any other way. But as someone who sat on the outskirts of those press conferences before, that's purely par for the course.
Well, I was thinking how ironic it was when the last question came about, you know, you being too insular and not socializing enough. He took the socializing and said, you know, I play golf with Boehner and I'm getting to be a lonely guy. I'd like to have more people. You know, I think that was his levity of things. But the fact of the matter is, too insular also suggests maybe too insular where the media is concerned. And he's been criticized from the beginning almost on that score.
You know, you listen to that answer, and again, this gets away from the policy and onto Obama as a person, but yeah, you listen to that answer about why don't you socialize more. I thought he was going to say, look, I'm a president of the United States, and I'm, you know, the dad of two teenage girls. What do you think this is, American president, like in the movie, where I can be single, have a teenage girl, date Annette Bening? I mean, that's ridiculous. That's the movies. But instead he said, I promise you Michelle and I are very nice to them when I invite members of Congress over. I'm just looking at these quotes here. He talks about how, you know, we're nice people. I like a big party. You don't look at Barack Obama and think he's the kind of guy who likes a big party. That's not who he is. And that response was sort of ridiculous. But, you know, that's not the stuff of real politics anymore. There's this image that, you know, Ronald Reagan and Tip O'Neill used to kick back and, you know, drink whiskey together, and that made things better back in the good old days. You know, the good old days also had, like when Tip O'Neill was there, what, there were 15 women in the U.S. House of Representatives, practically no one of color. The good old days had its problems, too. It was a much more homogeneous group of people, and I think that the fact that the president's not a backslapper the way that Bill Clinton is not the source of his trouble.
Yeah, but he also had to respond to the fact that his cabinet in recent appointments has not been as diverse as many would hope or expect. In fact, it's even been called a good old boys club, which is ironic given an African-American president. But I want to go get some callers on here. And before I do, I have to ask you about his comments about Newtown and about essentially gun legislation. He, you know, pretty much said, well, I'm going to wait until what Vice President Biden has to say and look that over, his recommendations and so forth. But he did mention certain things that he said were characteristic of his positions, you know, more background checks, magazine clips, doing a better job with them in terms of taking them outside of the hands of those who might be dangerous, and an assault weapons ban, which may indeed not get through. And he kind of intimated that, again, everything seems to depend on the Congress.
This is going to be a test of his leadership, because this is one of those issues where if he says the vice president's being offered this, I'm sending this over to the House and we'll see what they do. This is, surprisingly to me, a month after those shootings, the kind of issue where a lot of moderate Republicans have said absolutely nothing in terms of breaking with the NRA. If the president uses his inaugural address next Monday, if he uses his State of the Union address next month to say this is insanity and we're, you know, going to go to the districts of those people who are supported by the NRA and ask them, you know, why do you need an assault weapon to hunt? If he raises the stakes like that, he could score a victory on it, but it'll be very difficult. And perhaps the lesson he learned from health care in the first term is that these costly victories then injure him in other ways. But we'll see. He clearly was ready to have another event later this week where he's going to talk about gun control with the vice president. And I'll be very curious to see how much this comes up in his inaugural address, which is a week from today.
I also said it's hard to argue that gun owners have had their rights infringed, but of course he's certainly keen on recognizing at this point that many of the gun owners, particularly the NRA, are feeling as if they're going to be infringed upon. And when he talked about an individual walking into a store and just buying guns, he wasn't really talking about what happened in Newtown, because this was a young man who took the guns out of his own home.
I love the reporters. They're trying to push him. You know, they said, what do you make of all these people out there buying guns? And he said, well, you know, and remember that line of his from 4 years ago in the campaign where he said, people in hard times cling to God and religion and guns. And
it was about Pennsylvania, in fact, yeah.
Yeah, got him in a lot of trouble. So you could see the reporters pushing, saying, because he said, well, I think it's because the gun industry sort of gins up this fear and people rush out to get, because they're going to take all your guns away. And the reporter followed up saying, so you're saying those people are irrational. They're basing this on irrational fear with the sort of the dreams of the headline. President calls gun owners irrational, headline in their heads. But the president has learned something about politics and was very careful to say, I'm not saying that that they're being irrational. I'm just saying that the gun industry has an interest in this.
Yeah, an economic interest is how he put it. That was actually a lot more clever when you think about that Pennsylvania gaffe and what was made out of it with guns and Bibles being people clinging to. Let me bring our callers into this. And Craig, let's begin with you. Good morning.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
This comment is about the debt ceiling, and it seems to me that Congress has the power of the purse. Congress passes legislation. Congress authorizes a budget. Congress is responsible for incurring the debts that we have, and now they have a second bite at the pie to say, oh, yeah, we authorized this, but we're going to choose not to pay for it. Congress is being ridiculously irresponsible in threatening to not increase debt on bills they have incurred. It sends a bad message to the American public. It sends a bad message to those who hold our debt. It sends a bad message to the world. And the fact of the matter is, up until 2011, a debt ceiling increase was a matter of course. It is the conservative Congress that has decided to hold the American budget and debt hostage, and in doing so has reduced our debt rating. The president is not the one drawing the line in the sand.
Actually, Craig, I appreciate your comments. I want to just actually add to them. I'm looking at an email here from a fellow in Oakland who says, How can Obama be criticized for drawing a tough line with Republicans and risking the end of a working relationship? There is no working relationship. He tried that. It didn't work. This is a new tactic. Mark Sandlow.
Well, there's a point to both of them. And Craig is absolutely right that this is the president paying for bills that Congress has already incurred. But of course, it gets more complicated. The president used what I thought was a very smart analogy. He said it's like you go to dinner. At the end of dinner, you say, you know what, we can't afford this anymore, so let's not pay the bill. It's an irresponsible way to do things. What you should do is have a conversation about maybe not going out to dinner the next night, which is what the president said he's willing to do. It's a good analogy, but there are some flaws to it because it's more complicated. Part of the money that Congress has authorized is not only money that the United States has spent in the past. So it's not just, you know, rebuilding federal money that's gone to San Francisco to pay for some Bay Bridge repairs. It's also money that Congress has committed years and years down the line. And what Republicans will argue is we could easily keep the debt limit the way it is if you could only come out and support reducing that later. Now, Craig is right that that ultimately that's up to Congress. But the best way to add to the president's analogy, perhaps, would be to recognize how complicated it is. It's as if you're fighting with your partner at a restaurant and, you know, she said we really shouldn't have gone out to dinner in the first place, and you said yes, we should. And so at the restaurant, she says, you know what? The only way we're going to get you in order and agree with me next time is for me to be difficult and make a scene here at the restaurant. I mean, that's kind of what's going on. But the call is right and the president is right. This is the president who, under law, must spend this money because Congress has authorized it and appropriated it, and him as the executive branch has to execute Congress's authorizations. And now Congress is saying, oh, but we're not going to give you the ability to actually carry those out.
Well, he kept saying over and over again, in effect, you know, we have to pay our bills, so we can't be deadbeats. I want to give you a glimpse, as well as our listeners, Mark, of response already, which comes from John Boehner, who's right after the press conference came out and said the American people don't support raising the debt ceiling unless the government also cuts spending. And here's a statement, in effect, I'm quoting now from House Speaker Boehner, the American people do not support raising the debt ceiling without reducing government spending at the same time. The consequences of failing to increase the debt ceiling are real, but so too are the consequences of allowing our spending problem to go unresolved. Without meaningful action, the debt will continue to act as an anchor on our economy, costing American jobs and endangering our children's future. That was almost predictable.
Well, not raising the debt ceiling won't affect the debt is the problem, because not raising the debt ceiling doesn't, you know, what it does is, as the president points out, cause the United States to default on its loan. So the president said, it's fine, I'm willing to talk about negotiating on the budget after we do this. And what Republicans say is, you're not being sincere here. You say you're willing to negotiate, but the minute we approve a debt ceiling, you're going to say, how dare the Republicans try to take away from the poor with Medicare and Social Security. So yes, the president, no question, Republicans are using this as a, you know, as a blackmail weapon. And the president, who I started out saying is typically not very good at it, I thought found a very effective way to frame that, saying that this is not a debate about our budget. This is a debate about us being a deadbeat nation. And we can't be a deadbeat nation. And in fact, that would only add to our economic problems.
And here's a tweet from one of our listeners, Genevieve, who says, if Obama socialized more, Republicans would scream that he's too sociable and should get back to work. Let me get another caller on. Mark, join us. You're on.
Hi. I'd like to suggest, first of all, that the convoluted use of analogies is not helping. Let's put it the way it really is. If Congress wants to reduce their commitment, their spending, the way to do that is through their budgeting process. And everybody knows that. And every president that's needed has gotten automatic limits, debt ceiling limits created. And NPR folks miss that. Oh, no, it's always been a political issue. It has not been a political issue. The issue is that the Republicans, especially the Tea Party folks, are going to be against anything that Obama proposes, and they have been from day one. And this is just one more way to make to stop the government from working, which is really their ultimate objective.
Mark Sandler.
Mark, you're right, and as much as I love analogies, you're right, they oversimplify things. I mean, the fact is that the House Republicans have voted and approved a plan. A majority of the House of Representatives, the United States, has approved a plan to dramatically reduce the debt and the deficit. Now, they did this with, you know, draconian cuts that would be change the government's relationships to its people. The problem is Republicans can't get their way because they happen to have a minority in the Senate, and there is no chance that, you know, California senators or Democrats are going along with this Paul Ryan budget, and there's no chance the president would sign it. So, I mean, Mark is right. If Congress wanted to do this, they could do this on their own, reduce spending. But we have a divided Congress. Republicans are not capable of pulling this off unilaterally, and since Democrats now hold the White House, Congress is saying, fine, we're going to, you know, use our one arm of the House of Representatives and try to hold you hostage, and the president's, you know, going to call them out on it. So we've got about 3 weeks, apparently, maybe 4 weeks at most, until this debt ceiling happens. And anyone who watched that fiscal cliff debate understands that, just like a journalist, these folks are going to wait till the very last second to come up with a deal.
And we will continue, obviously, to monitor this and stay tuned as this unfurls. I want to thank Mark Sandler, joined us from the nation's capital, Associate Academic Director for the University of California's Washington Center and Washington Editor of the California News Service. Mark, good to have you with us. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Mark.
And thank you, our listeners. We have another hour ahead. We had scheduled Daniel Pink for this hour. We're going to meet him in the hour coming up. His new book is To Sell as Human, The Surprising Truth About Moving Others. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny.